One of the most popular discussions around every dinner table in South Africa this year has been a book called The President's Keepers, which if you haven't read it yet, you're probably going to be reading it during your holidays. Jacques Poe, the author, popped in to see us and we actually sat in my office. He arrived with two bodyguards. He arrived with his publicist and he didn't seem nervous, although there was an air of nervousness around him. He was very much the man of the moment when he came in to see us, and his book has done incredible things. In fact, it's grabbed so much attention that bookstores cannot keep the book in stock. They keep reordering it. It's probably the most successful book in South Africa of the last 5 years. He's exposed some of what his research has identified as the darkest secret at the heart of this administration. A very compromised government with the president right in the middle. A cancerous cabal that eliminates the president's enemies and purges law enforcement agencies of good men and women. And I think, if you missed it, this will be a great one to recap before we go into the new year and the December conference. CliffCentral.com. Jacques Poe is sitting opposite me, and we've checked the windows to make sure there aren't any assassins with sniper rifles anywhere nearby. He is traveling with bodyguards. I suppose you have to after writing something like this. Did you anticipate this?
Well, when before we published the book, we anticipated that there's going to be a severe response from the law enforcement agencies, and that they're going to be very unhappy about this. I never contemplated driving around with a bodyguard, and I feel very uneasy about it. It's not something I want. Definitely not. And I don't want all the attention either, I can assure you.
I know you mean that, because Jacques, your reputation precedes you, and really there are journalists who are saying, Mandy Weiner, I read a piece from her this morning where she said if she had to choose someone to go to war for the Fourth Estate, it would be you. So you're held in very high esteem, but I also know you started your book by saying you wanted to get out of this. You went and opened up this place in Riebeek Kasteel. I mean, well, of all places, you couldn't wish to be more of a nobody.
I said to someone yesterday, I feel a bit like a rehabilitated heroin addict that was handed a syringe full of heroin, and I couldn't help injecting myself again. When I got the opportunity to write again, I took it. Because I suppose, you know, once you've been a journalist, and I've been a journalist for 30 years, on and off for 33 years, in fact, I suppose it stays in your blood, you know, you always go back to it.
Well, you detail quite nicely in your book, which starts off in the most gripping fashion with your laptop having disappeared and ends off in a gripping fashion where you're kind of saying, well, we're fucked, but here's how. We're fucked. And in between, you explain how you and Max Dupree, who go back a long way with the Freiwillig Blood and then Special Assignment and all of these other things that you've done together, where he said, you've got to write this book.
Yeah, I mean, Max is partly responsible for this book because he's been encouraging me for some time to write again. And when I got the information about the corruption in state security, I said to Max, now what do I do? And he said to me, you have to start writing again. Remember, this is going to be the third time you do national service. The first time was as a young white man in the old apartheid South Africa, where I went to the army for 2 years. The second was when we had Freiwillig Blood, and this is the third time. So I suppose in a certain sense, it's doing national service. You know, I had to do it, and I think we all have to do our bit at the moment. Otherwise, we are going to become a gangster state.
Some would say we already are, and after reading your book, I feel much worse than I did before. So I don't know whether to be pleased about sitting opposite you or not, because you've kind of ruined my life, and I think a lot of South Africans will be waking up after reading this with a renewed outlook. I suddenly realized that all this nonsense of, you know, white and black and ANC and DA and EFF and all of these smoke screens that are they don't matter to the president at all. He could care less about white monopoly capital. He's so busy, according to your book, this man is so busy creating a shadow state that he's paid 0.001% of his time and attention to being president.
Well, you know, if the president had cared an iota of what's going on in the country, he wouldn't have destroyed the law enforcement agencies.
No.
He wouldn't want to enter...
He wouldn't have destroyed SARS.
Absolutely.
I This was something, and you credit them rightly as saying they were our strongest law enforcement agency.
They were our leading light. They were respected internationally for their ability to collect taxes on behalf of the state. Now, after he destroyed SARS, they've already recorded a 30 billion rand in the previous tax year, and this tax year they're going to have a 50 billion rand
shortfall.
And this is the money that's supposed to pay social grants. This is the money that's supposed to pay for the police, build hospitals, build schools. And people have to realize that if we can't, can you imagine we get to a point where we can't pay social grants, the potential for civil disobedience and unrest in this country? And that's why it seems as though Jacob Zuma is living on a parallel universe. You know, a few years ago, we were still talking about corruption in terms of millions. Now we talk in terms of billions. Now we want to go and enter it into a nuclear deal that's going to cost us a trillion. You know, it is just astonishing what is happening at the moment.
Well, the crime has been, in the words of Silicon Valley, scaled up.
Absolutely, and there's no possibility, at least in the medium term, that we are going to be able to bring crime down. Because we've lost the ability of our law enforcement agencies to deal with crime. When is the last time you've heard about a major criminal syndicate being busted? It hasn't happened for a long, long time.
When last did the Hawks do anything?
And crime intelligence has not been doing anything for the past 7 years.
What charges has Sean Abrams brought against anyone of significance in the last in the entire period of his tenure?
And if you think about something like the Gupta emails, where there's so much prima facie evidence of fraud and corruption and money laundering, where's the investigations? Where's the prosecutions?
It's not state capture, it's state rape.
Yes, and it's become relatively safe to be an organized criminal in this country because you're probably not going to be arrested or apprehended.
And it's probably safe to not pay tax too because they wouldn't know whether they were Arthur or Martha when it comes to figuring out the tax system as well.
Absolutely. So that's why I say, you know, and I prefer to be softer on it, and that's why I say we're on the verge of becoming a gangster state. Because once the law enforcement agencies can't apprehend organized criminals or bust criminal syndicates, then we have a huge, huge problem.
I read the whole book in a day, and there wasn't any part of it that I thought, I can skip this chapter. Because you've gone to incredible lengths to detail the characters, the situations. In very many of these stories, you even have sources so close to the action that they were in meetings where the president got up and shouted and screamed. Mm. I'm fascinated at how many people are enveloped in his sphere of influence and how many people he has brought in from the cold, so to speak, people who are completely unqualified for their jobs, people who would otherwise find no meaningful or gainful employment, that he's had to put into positions based purely on the fact that they will be loyal to him.
Mm, absolutely. You know, when Zuma came to power in May 2009, we have to understand one thing about his presidency is his major goal has been to stay out of court, to avoid being charged. On the one hand, to use the legal process to draw out the possibility of being charged for as long as possible, and that's still in the courts. And then the other one is by placing his cronies in crucial positions in the law enforcement agencies, he's going to avoid prosecution. And if you look at the history of the law enforcement agencies, if you look at the history of the Hawks, for example, when Zuma came to power, the Hawks, well, it was only the start of the Hawks because he disbanded the Scorpions. But for the first 2-3 years of his presidency, the Hawks operated relatively well under Anwar Rumat.
They were kind of like the Scorpions.
Yes. And then Anwar Rumat was removed. People like Shadrach Sabir was removed. Johan Boysen was removed. So he dealt with the Hawks. Then came crime intelligence.
And all the while, by the way, Jeff Khadebe presides over this, never lifting a finger.
Never
objecting once.
Never, no.
And now he wants to be taken seriously.
Absolutely, yeah. And then you take an organization like Crime Intelligence, who is crucial in fighting organized crime, is Lieutenant General Richard Medluli was suspended in 2011. He was suspended 6 years ago. He's still the commander of the unit. He still gets his monthly salary, even got a bonus while he was sitting at home. Since then, there were a succession of acting crime intelligence commanders, and one after the other messed up. There's a 600 million rand secret fund in crime intelligence. You know, that's the fund from where they pay agents and whatever. They've been raping that fund. Nothing has happened.
Now, this was the part of the book that I really didn't expect, and there are a lot of clangers in this book. I don't understand why the Sunday Times chose to focus on the Nkosi Sana Dlamini Zuma cigarette stuff, because it's such a minor piece of the puzzle. Mm. But this guy, Arthur Fraser, who is Geraldine Fraser Moleketi's brother.
Yes.
What's the story with him? Because he was the guy who operated the slush fund.
Yes.
In intelligence. And intelligence is murky because we're not always allowed to ask questions.
Well, state security is shrouded in secrecy. You're not allowed to know how many people work there. You're not allowed to know what their annual budget is. I can tell you, but you're going to be in trouble if I tell you. The Auditor General doesn't audit their books. Even the Parliamentary Committee on Intelligence only gets the broad figures of what the state security budget is, and they all under an oath of secrecy, they're never supposed to reveal it. So nobody knows what's going on in state intelligence, except that we know that the state security agency has increased tremendously over the past decade. More and more agents. Now, Arthur Fraser was the Deputy Director General of the State Security Agency when he initiated a project called the PAN Project. PAN simply stands for the Principal Agent Network. And that was to expand the intelligence capability of state security, and there's, in principle, nothing wrong with it. And then Intelligence Minister Ronnie Casserells, in fact, approved the project. Then Casserells left. And over a period, and I'll make it short, it gets quite complicated. Over a period of about 3 years, a billion rand of state, of taxpayers' money was pumped into the PAN projects. 72 agents had access to almost 300 cars. These cars were kept in three warehouses across the country. They bought houses and then they would rent the houses back to
the NIA.
Back to state security. You know, SARS did some lifestyle audits on the top managers, and you could see the money flowing into their bank accounts, and now they bought cars and double-story villas and whatever. Now, there's two crucial things here. The one is that they used the original approval of Casserells, and they copy and pasted his signature to submit to the finance department of state security to get the cash to be delivered. Now, Ronnie Casserells is speaking about it at the moment. In fact, I spoke to him on Monday night about this, where he says he can remember that the investigators who investigated this came to him and showed him these documents, and where he said to them, yeah, I mean, that's kind of my signature, but I don't remember this document. So that's the one thing. That's how they got all the money. And the investigators, there was a team of internal state security investigators, and there were two state advocates was part of this investigation, found tremendous wastage and corruption and whatever. But very interestingly, they also found that Arthur Fraser, who ran the PAN project, had his own server installed in his house, his own state security server, computer server installed in his house. And all the intelligence reports of the PAN agents went to his server. And he would then decide what he was going to send into the state security mainframe to be analyzed. That they found 800 reports that he never sent to state security. And they found that he was trying to set up a parallel intelligence organization.
Prima facie evidence of treason.
Yeah, they recommended that he be charged with treason.
I mean, that's treason, and we know there's fraud when it comes to copying the minister's signature and all of that stuff. So how come this guy was then reappointed later on?
No, well, the interesting thing is then these people brought out their report, the the state security investigators, where they recommended that I think it's 11 or 12 people be criminally prosecuted, and then treason against Arthur Fraser, and they recommended sort of like how to get the cars back and find the houses and whatever. That report, the minister sent that report to the IGI, the Inspector General of Intelligence. She investigated for 3 years. It took her to bring out a report. Based on the report of the investigators.
This is Santo, I forget her surname.
That was Faith Khadebe.
Oh, Faith Khadebe, sorry.
She was the Inspector General. Yes. Now, what happened is, why it took her 3 years,
yeah,
is that in this 3 years, she continually wanted documentation from state security. And they had to manufacture a lot of the documentation. They called it the Musanda War Room, where people sat to manufacture documents for the Inspector General. And it took her 3 years to bring out a report to say, yeah, I've never seen the report. Nobody has ever seen the report. But it took her 3 years. And apparently she says in her report, yeah, there was a few shortcomings. And here and there, there were things that was not done according to the book, but it was actually not that bad. So Arthur Fraser got himself exonerated. And then inexplicably, he was appointed in 2016 as South Africa's spy boss. He's now the head of the State Security Agency.
Now, I mean, he should be, if the president's enemy number one, he should be somewhere in the top five.
Yes, absolutely.
Because this man has an incredible power, an ability to invade our privacy, an ability to turn a blind eye to crime, an ability to report what he wants to the president. But the president relies on his briefings for, yeah, what he knows to be going on in the state, whether it's a
absolutely
security threat.
You know,
or not.
They should, for example, be, people always look at the hawks, for example, to investigate the Gupta leaks. So now we talk about corruption, fraud, money laundering. In fact, state intelligence has got a unit that works on organized crime. Now, we can also reason that there is there's economic treason has been committed by the Guptas and their cronies against the South African state. If you think all the money they've taken from the state-owned enterprises. Therefore, state intelligence would be vital in the investigation against the Guptas. Nothing has been done.
You know, by comparison with the amount of coverage that they've been getting in the news, you didn't put a huge amount of effort into the Guptas here.
No, you know what? I tried to steer away from the Guptas because so much is already available.
And you give credit to Peter Louis Myburgh and, yeah, people like that who've done a lot of the work in that sphere.
Yeah.
But what amazed me is that you spent an inordinate amount of time, and all of it was fascinating, on Tom Moyane.
Mm.
Because while the capture of the state security agency is obviously immediate threat to us. SARS, where the money comes from.
Yes.
The president is willing to sacrifice all the good that SARS represents, even if it's just because it gives him more to steal.
Yeah.
In order to destroy and take apart the mechanisms that would otherwise have investigated him, Edward Zuma,
yes,
Duduzane,
yes,
and very many of his other
colleagues. You must remember by 2014, when the Hawks was already sick and crime intelligence already in a critical state, SARS was still operating. And they were doing absolutely magnificent work. If you think it wasn't the Hawks that brought down Lolly Jackson or Glenn Agliotti or even Radovan Krecher or people like that.
It was taxes that brought down Al Capone.
Exactly. It was SARS that brought them down. SARS had this incredible investigative capacity to go after organized crime and organized criminals. And in my book, I distinguish between two SARS regimes. The old SARS regime is that of Pravin Gordhan, of Ivan Pillay, and of Opa Magashule. And that lasted until the end of 2014. And then you have the new SARS regime of Tom Moyane. The old SARS regime, besides going after the organized criminals, also had a policy that every taxpayer is going to be treated equal. And that includes the president, who was for SARS I can't say he was just an ordinary criminal.
He was a problem child.
He was his tax affairs was handled by the VIP taxpayers unit, which is a unit in SARS that try and settle the tax affairs of prominent individuals amicably. They try
before
and solve...
Before they become a public embarrassment.
Yeah, before SARS then becomes embroiled in politics. That was very important for them. So,
and the president's tax history is something that also...
Well, his tax history is lamentable. I mean, you know, very few people are aware of the fact that already in 2007, he had to pay an admission of guilt for his tax affairs. And SARS has been... The president was tax compliant when he became president in May 2009. SARS helped him to become tax compliant, but they took him to court where he...
It was largely because he was running at a debt.
Exactly, for the longest time.
And, you know.
And there was a big problem about all the payments he had received previously from Shabir Sheikh and even Nelson Mandela.
And those are the ones we knew about.
That ones we knew
as
about.
As you detail in here, there are also innumerable sources who tell you about brown envelopes and...
Yes, yes. But then the president didn't submit his tax returns for the first year of his presidency, neither the second year, neither the third year. And by 2014, he hadn't submitted any tax returns yet, which led to a meeting, and I've got a very good record of this meeting, in February 2014 between Acting SARS Commissioner Ivan Pillay and Zuma, where Pillay said to him, "Listen, Mr. President, we can't wait any longer for your tax returns. We will now have to treat you as an ordinary taxpayer." Zuma's fear was that if it was just about his presidential salary every month, it would have been very easy for him to become tax compliant. Because he's a salary earner. He gets a salary, tax gets deducted, so there was absolutely no problem. I mean, his tax returns could have been filled in within an hour. But there was a reason why Jacob Zuma didn't submit his tax returns, because there was number one, payments that he was not entitled to as president. Payments came from Royal Security, which belongs to Roy Moodley, who's an old Zuma crony. And much has been written about Moodley and the tenders he got afterwards and whatever. Old crony of Zuma. In fact, Zuma was the guest of honor at his 50th birthday party in Durban, where Moodley's son made a speech and he pointed to his father and he said, "My father is the most powerful man in the country."
And the president laughed.
Well, the president didn't do anything, because I think the president knew. And then there was, of course, another tax problem Zuma had was the Nkandla upgrades. And in my book, I mentioned the legislation. It's quite complicated, but every person has to pay for the upgrades on his property, whether it's to his benefit or not, and whether he's asked for it or not. You have to pay your taxes. There is no way of getting around that. So he had to pay the taxes on the Nkandla upgrades. SARS calculated, and I've got the exact amount in my book, is that he owed just over 63 million rand for the Nkandla upgrades. Now, his problem is, if SARS, after Pillay said to him, "Listen, we're now going to treat you as a normal taxpayer," his fear was he could obviously not afford his upgrades, can't afford the money. You know, when he had to pay 8 or 9 million rand for the upgrades as determined by the Constitutional Court in the end, he had to scrounge in the northernmost province to find a bank in Venda to give him a loan. So he couldn't afford the taxes. There's no question about that. His fear was that if SARS unleashed a full tax audit against him, he could have been sequestrated, and of which I don't know how likely that was, but that was a possibility. And an insolvent cannot be the president of the country. So he virtually had no other option but to purge SARS of these people that threatened him, and not only him, but also his family and his cronies.
Now, when we were all watching this unfold, when we saw Nhlanhla Nene being fired and we saw SARS being dismantled, Tom Moyane being moved in there, we had some inkling of that there were troubles underfoot, right? But we didn't know. Did you know all of this was happening? Your sources were telling you in real time what was going on?
You know, in 2014, when the whole SARS rogue unit saga started. And very, very quickly for your listeners, what happened is 2 weeks after Moyani arrived at SARS, the Sunday Times started publishing allegations that SARS ran a rogue unit and that this rogue unit spied on Zuma and they had a brothel and whatever. And this was the pretext for Moyani to suspend the top structure, to get rid of those nasties, to get rid of Ivan Pillay and those people. Anyway, at the time when the Sunday Times ran the rogue unit stories, I was the head of investigations at Media 24 newspapers. And I did the counter stories in City Press that this was in fact a state security campaign against Johan van Lochrenberg, who was the head of investigations. Shortly after I wrote the story, I left journalism. And then the Sunday Times just sort of took over and continued running with their spy stories.
The Sunday Times never really faced up and owned up to being involved in fake news. Are their journalists still in employ? These journalists who spread these scurrilous stories?
There were three journalists that wrote the stories. Two of them left. The editor left. A new editor took over. And SARS has apologized they were forced by the press ombudsman to apologize. And then they had a full page apology where they said their reportage was wrong.
But the damage was done.
The good guys were gone. And that is how Moyani purged.
But they tried it again with Pravin Gordhan.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So these are people who are very good at misinformation.
Yeah. Excellent. And I mean, from their point of view, the SARS rogue unit stories were brilliantly executed. The campaign was brilliantly executed.
Tremendous success. Everybody bought it. And also, I'm surprised it didn't have a much more adverse long-term effect on a publication like the Sunday Times, which should have known better.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about it. You know, I have a very good relationship now with the editor. And he admits, you know, that they did wrong. I mean, in fact, I was on another radio show yesterday when I spoke to CBS McKaiser, and while we were in the studio, one of the journalists who did the stories, Stefan Hofstadter, pitched up.
Oh, yeah?
And he wanted to defend himself.
How did that go?
Not very well for him, because he admitted in the end, he first started by saying, well, he was actually not the main writer and whatever.
Yeah.
And then it later turned out that they didn't really do their homework and, you know, their sources had it wrong.
So you should rather have shut up. It was almost better to have kept quiet.
You should have shut up. I mean, when you've done something like that, you walk away and start anew and hope the trouble goes away.
So what is SARS looking like at the moment? I mean, what's going on there now? Because you still have sources inside. And by the way, we'll get to your sources in a minute, because there's this quandary where a lot of people, if they criticize you at all, it'll be about these unnamed sources, which you have to have in journalism. Mm. You've grown a reputation based on years and years of gathering information from people who don't want to be named, whistleblowers, people who are inside these things. But inside SARS right now, what's the state of affairs?
Well, I don't have the exact figure, but within a year that Tom Moyani took over, 56 managers, the vast majority of them very competent, left SARS. He also introduced new systems in SARS. As I said, very competent managers left. The top executive, the people that really knew what SARS was about and really knew the tax system, most of them had left as well. He disbanded all five investigative units that was under Johan van Lochrenberg. These were the units that hunted down the organized criminals and the people like that. He's disbanded all the five units. Most of the members of those units are gone, or they've been removed to other units within SARS where they play a very minor role at the moment, which means SARS has lost its investigative capacity. But the The devastation of Moyani goes much further, and I'm going to give you a quick example. In 2014, before they left, the old SARS submitted tax bills to a series of very notorious criminals, many of them, in fact, tobacco smugglers. One of the people that got a tax bill was a guy by the name of Robert Wong, who's a Chinese immigrant, came to South Africa in the early 90s, was then convicted of murder, and spent some time in prison. In the end, he spent very little time in prison, if you think about it. He committed a murder, but anyway. Got out of prison, started an import-export business, and Kulabusi Zuma became the chairperson of the company. Mr. Wong then accompanied the president on a business visit to China, and during the 2014 elections, he imported T-shirts for the ANC. So he's a big crony. He's in there. SARS slammed him with a tax bill of R1 billion. That R1 billion very quickly grew to R3 billion because of interests and penalties and things like that. The same they gave Mr. Mark Liffman, who's a gangster in Cape Town, they gave him a tax bill of R288 million. Mr. Adriano Mazzotti, who's the director of Carnelinks, him and his company got a tax bill of R600 million. Now, Mr. Mazzotti is a self-confessed criminal. I have an affidavit where he says, yes, I'm a smuggler, I'm a fraudster, I've bribed SARS officials, I've attempted to bribe Ivan Pillay and Johan van Lochrenberg. What these gangsters have done now is they went back, after they got their tax bills. Now, these tax bills should have been settled a long time ago. But they went back to SARS after Moyani took over, and they said to Moyani, listen, the units that investigated us were rogue. You said so yourself. So these tax bills cannot be accepted. So those tax bills have never been settled. And that's the devastating part of SARS, is that these people are now getting away with
these
their
crooks.
Tax bills. These crooks. If you think about a man like Mark Liffman, who's directly involved in the gang violence in the Western Cape at the moment, he should have been a broken man by now. He should have been sequestrated for his R288 million. I've got documentation where the SARS officials say, you know, we can, where they do lifestyle audits on him, and they've recorded all his properties and whatever. They were ready to bring him down. His tax bill has never been settled, which has enabled him to continue his gangster activities in the Western Cape. If you think like Mr. Wong, now in the previous tax year, Tom Moyani had a shortfall of R30 billion. Just Robert Wong's bill could have been 10% of the shortfall. It's gone. SARS doesn't have an investigative capacity anymore.
So then, you know how people were spreading around your PDF of your book? Which I don't have a lot of time for, because I think it's,
you know
you're going to need the legal fees, if nothing else.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
But people were spreading this around, right?
Yes.
People who didn't buy the book were spreading it around. We're a gangster nation. What did you expect?
Yeah.
But if we can do that, we should be able to organize fairly simply a tax revolt. They wouldn't be able to do very much about that either, would they?
No.
Not this SARS.
You know,
the old SARS, maybe.
I hope if one thing good comes out of this book, it is to mobilize people. You know, we have to realize, you know, I've always said, we only have three pillars standing between us and a gangster state. And the one is the courts.
Mm-hmm.
And the courts have been magnificent. The second is the media, who has to expose and
not aid and abet.
No. And who has
like producing
to expose.
Fake news. Yeah.
And the third one is civil society. That's mm-hmm. me and you and the people, your listeners and people out there. Is we cannot sit back and say, well, there's nothing we can do. We all have to rise up against this. And we have seen it since the emergence of the Gupta emails, that civil society has been mobilized, and they're doing fantastic work at the moment. But that's, if one of those three pillars fail, we will be a gangster state.
There are some people in your story who come across as quite sympathetic characters. I say story, I don't mean fiction, obviously. Johan van Lochrenberg, this guy, I mean, what a dedicated civil servant. He almost had no life. And then
there's several of them.
Then there's this honey trap.
Yeah.
I mean, there's stories in here that on their own could be books.
Yes.
And movies.
There's incredible, there's a, there's a band of incredibly dedicated civil servants, policemen, SARS officials, Hawks officers that we've lost.
Why don't you tell me about Nom Kobo Jiba for a second?
Advocate Jiba is, well, she's close, first of all, she's close to Jacob Zuma, and that's been reported over and over and over. She's got an excellent relationship with Richard Madluli, the suspended head of the Crime Intelligence Service. And she was inexplicably appointed by Jacob Zuma to be the acting head of the National Prosecuting Authority, despite several court judgments that were scathing of Advocate Jiba and her conduct as a legal officer of the NPA.
So much so she's been disbarred. Right?
She's now been disbarred. She was disbarred by two high court judges. She's now taken it on appeal. And as I say, very close to Richard Madluli. Richard Madluli should have been charged a long time ago for fraud and corruption. And she was always the one who refused to sign the prosecutions.
Is Richard Madluli in the top 5 or top 10 crooks?
Probably top 5.
Oh, really?
And he's been there for a long time. Anyway, she's always refused to charge him. In the same time, she has campaigned against people like General Johan Boysen, who was the head of the Hawks in KwaZulu-Natal. Glynis Breytenbach. Now, Glynis Breytenbach was intent on charging Richard Madluli. So they started a campaign against Glynis. Johan Boysen was intent on prosecuting Toshin Pandey, which is a big Zuma crony, in KwaZulu-Natal. Boysen spent the last 5 years of his life in the police fighting suspension after suspension after suspension. And Jiba was really gunning for him. And part of this, amongst others, some of the scathing judgments are in KwaZulu-Natal during her efforts to charge Johan Boysen. And then during the writing of this book, somebody gave me a document, an official police document. And it was a report drawn up by a Hawks colonel. During this investigation into the fraud and corruption it was done by the old Hawks, the Hawks of Anwar Ramat.
Those of repute.
Yeah, absolutely. And during the investigation into Richard Madluli in 2011, one of the Hawks discovered, for example, plane tickets that were paid from the slush fund. That's just about what it was. From the Crime Intelligence Secret Fund was used to pay, for example, for air tickets for Jiba. And remember what her constitutional duties was as the head of the NPA. She had to be fiercely independent. That's the first and the biggest requirement. So he found the fact that there were payments for her from the Crime Intelligence Secret Fund. He investigated that, and he came to the conclusion that she was agent number SA71 at Crime Intelligence.
Oh, that's quite a revelation.
Yeah, that's rather devastating.
And then NPA boss. You can't be NPA boss.
No, that's how deep the rot goes.
Are you afraid at the moment? Because you've put a whole lot of very dangerous people's names in this book. And some of them are not happy about it because they, up to now, were pinching their chubby flanks every morning and congratulating themselves on getting away with it. And now suddenly their names are out there and people like me and people like far more important and illustrious people who have connections to power and perhaps influence on society, maybe even influence on the ANC conference that's coming up, these people have now got ammo. Are you afraid that these very dangerous people are going to come for you?
You know, I was afraid is not quite the right word, but I was very cautious before the book was published. Less so now, but because the book is out there. I mean, if somebody clubs me now, I mean, it's not going to mean anything because the book is out. I was rather concerned before we published the book, but more concerned about legal action to ban the book before it got published. Am I scared? No, but I'm still concerned. You know, I got some death threats. No, I've always said that if somebody wants to kill you, they're not going to warn you beforehand.
So if someone calls you and says, I'm going to kill you, you're probably not.
Tell them to F off, quite
frankly. Is that your response?
Yes.
Who do you think the most dangerous people in this country are right now? I mean, the president's backed into a corner somewhat because a lot of this is unwelcome as a public exhibit A for him.
You know, there's because of the law enforcement agencies falling apart, there's evidence that there's rogue units at the moment.
Under Burning and Tlemesa.
Yeah. And let's call them unofficial police units. And you think about the spate of break-ins we had, you know, break-ins into the
Chief Justice,
the NPA, things like that. You talk about, you know, the spate of assassinations in KwaZulu-Natal, for example. And there's evidence which is being investigated at the moment by IPID, the Independent Police Investigative Directorate. I don't know how far they're going to get. But anyway, that there's these rogue policemen. Apparently they occupied some rooms in the Sheraton Hotel in Pretoria for some time. There's evidence to that effect as well. And it's this band of policemen that answer to no one, but they're top commanders. And as I've mentioned to you before, there's these secret funds where money is available. There's vast amount of money in these secret funds. So there's funds to finance operations like this. And I think that's the scary part we're in. And the big question is, are they going to play a role in the ANC elective conference in December?
If they did play a role, if their role was proactive, would their role be in support of Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma?
One would presume.
And is she, in all of the conversations you've had in putting this book together, is she just a proxy for the president? Is she just useful to keep him out of jail? Is that his get out of jail free card?
Well, you know, I'm not a political analyst.
No, sure. But
from
what
you've
heard,
the indications are, if you look at the people that she's surrounded herself with, S. Magashula, whose sons are employed by the Guptas, for example, people like David Mabuza in
Mpumalanga,
it is incredibly scary people. And there's absolutely no doubt that if she comes to power, she's going to owe these people some favors because they're supporting her. So it's very difficult to see how she is going to turn away, to make a U-turn from the path that her ex-husband has taken for many, many years. So
maybe it would serve her purposes to just take his mantle on.
And that's the scary part. And if she's going to get into bed with people like Adriano Mazzotti, who I've just mentioned to you, who's absolutely notorious, he's helped her with her campaign, so she's going to owe him something. The man just bought himself a mine in the Limpopo province. And he says on his website he's a great proponent of radical economic transformation.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a man who's hidden his wealth and didn't pay his taxes that enable social welfare grants to be paid. You know, he hides away his money and he's a money launderer and a fraudster and whatever. Now he's in favor of radical economic transformation.
The big, loud socialists always are.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he's bought his mine. I'm sure more is to come. He says on his website he's a great proponent of the mining charter of Mining Minister Zwani. So he certainly expects his relationship with Nkosazana to bear some fruit.
Your sources, because if this does go to court, if these threats from the State Security Agency have any weight at all, if they actually follow through, would you welcome this for it to all go to court? Because the burden of proof would be on them, wouldn't
Listen,
it?
Listen, I don't want to spend the next 2 or 3 years of my life in court.
No, sure.
If that is what it's going to take to bring out the truth, then that's the path we have to take. Absolutely.
And you're confident because there are going to be people that pick this apart with a fine-tooth comb.
Yes.
You're confident that nothing you wrote in here is going to trip you up or discredit parts of this that may be true because they might be untrue.
No, I don't think so. And I already have a substantial bank of evidence that I can use.
Why is it that you think everyone wants to talk to you, Jacques? Why have you got the trust of so many people who've been thwarted?
You know, when I wrote this book, I think when I spoke to people, now you must remember that my conversations and my dealings with my sources wasn't once-off meetings.
Sure.
You know, it was meetings that took place over a period of time. And they, you know, they first
but some of these people are in no hurry to talk to you.
No.
Yeah.
And I think it helped that I wasn't a journalist anymore. So they weren't scared that I was suddenly going to publish something in the Sunday Times or City Press or wherever. That helped. But I don't know. I think it's also something you learn. You know, I used to lecture quite a lot on journalism. And I would always say to students, you have to learn how to cocoon people when you approach them. And I've always spoken about the cocooning techniques, how you get somebody to take you into his or her confidence, how you should approach people, what you should say and what you should not say. In this case, it was very difficult because I didn't only want information from people. I wanted documentation from people. I wanted more than just what they were telling me. And, you know, finally after they started speaking to me, I would say to them, okay, you know, I'm coming back to Gauteng or wherever I met them in 2 or 3 weeks' time. See whether you can find me a document or two, just something that substantiates what you've been telling me. So it was a long and difficult process, and I wasn't always successful. You know?
Are there things that you did not publish because you didn't have enough information, but that could be even bigger revelations?
Yeah, absolutely. There were things I just couldn't prove.
But that are maybe as big as some of the things in here?
Yes, as big as stuff already in the book, which is in the back of my mind, and who knows? You know, but I would like to go back to my little village, my guest house in Rubia Castile, and just sort of disappear again.
We need you. You've proven your usefulness and some. I'm looking for the silver lining here because I said, you know, tongue in cheek, that your book has depressed me. But actually, what you've revealed here is a huge amount of paranoia. There are a lot of people running scared. They can't trust each other, let alone us. There must be spies spying on spies spying on spies at the moment. I don't know how the president knows who he can trust and who he can't anymore.
Well, he's shown himself to be a very paranoid president. If you look at his personal security at the moment.
I saw him in Limpopo the other day. He had paramilitary guards with him in full fatigues.
Yes.
And I thought that's not, you know, that's the way that a banana republic despot travels around.
Absolutely not. And he definitely lives in a parallel universe. I mean, I don't think Jacob Zuma understands numbers. When his advisors tell him, but Mr. President, this nuclear deal is going to cost us $1 trillion+, I don't think he grasps the reality of it. And yes, there is certainly paranoia. There's groups, there's factions. And you know, I've always said, and I have to be careful how I say this, is that many politicians are nothing but prostitutes. They will look and they will decide in which direction they're going. Mm-hmm. And I think many people at the moment, somebody like David Mabuza in Mpumalanga, you know, there were reports that sort of like, you know, there was then sort of
you could
like
go
there,
either way.
There were sounds about Ramaphosa and now there's sounds again about Dlamini Zuma and whatever. And that's politics, eh? Is that people will go where there's the biggest benefit for them, not what is right. You know, I've always said to people, it's not going to be Parliament that's going to remove Zuma. It's not going to be a journalist, or it's definitely not going to be a book. The only body or the only organization that can remove Zuma is the NEC of the ANC. Problem is, Zuma employs half of them. And the Thabo Mbeki, the national executive, that's ministers and deputy ministers, was just over 30. It's now over 70. Most of them serve on the NEC of the ANC. Zuma employs them. It's
almost a third of the members of parliament in the ANC.
Yes. They're not going to stand up. You know, if people always ask, why is the NEC, why is the ANC doing nothing? It's because Zuma employs them. And I think we have to understand that when we think about the survival of Jacob Zuma. I don't think it's always because he's so brilliant. In fact, he's quite brutal. It's because of the fact that the ANC has lost their moral compass. It's now about what is to my benefit, what is going to benefit me, not what is going to benefit the voters or the country. That's the problem we're sitting with.
There are a few people here that I don't know how to read in your book. I don't. You aren't sure really whether Fikile Mbalula is a good guy or a bad guy or just a fool. I mean, I don't know. I can't work out what you think of him.
Well, when Mbalula took over, he was making the right noises.
Hmm. You mean as police minister?
As police minister. He was making the right noises. There's no question about that. You know, listen, we also, if you think about his predecessor, Nhleko, was a complete buffoon. But anyway, so when Mbalula took over, at least he made the right noises. In the meantime, he's embarrassed himself several times. And I mean, there's so many examples of that, you know, sort of like going to crunch their balls and sort of the arrests after Marikana massacres or the Marikana killings in the Western Cape. It's the same with somebody like Gigaba, for example, who's in the Zuma camp, but has spoken out against the nuclear. Well, he basically said there's not enough money for nuclear. Now again, there's a report today that Gigaba has seen representatives of the World Bank to discuss the nuclear deal with them. So, you know, which way these people will go, I don't know. How long Gigaba will last if he refuses to release enough money to clinch the nuclear deal, I don't know either.
Have you heard mutterings, because you've got sources in Russia as well, about how involved the Russians are with the president?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have much more of what is being said by people out there. But we know that there's a very close relationship between Zuma and Putin, and that there's certainly, I mean, Mashlobu flying to Russia in the presence of gangsters like Gaetan McKenzie, for example. So yeah, I mean, that's certainly been reported.
Well, Shark, it's an incredible read. I wish you luck. I hope that the results are good for South Africa. I mean, that's the purpose of putting something like this together. You certainly didn't do it to make your life more interesting. You were quite happy to keep it quiet and
Absolutely.
But I'm delighted you did. And thank you for writing this book. I hope that more and more people all over the world manage to read it and we get to see the ugly underbelly of this very kleptocratic regime.
Thank you, Cliff.
Thank you.
Pleasure talking to you.
Thanks.
Cliffcentral.com